Hey, this is Seth Wires from Channel 9, and we're here with a special guest. Tell us who you are and what you do.
I'm Dave Probert. I'm a kernel developer within the Windows Operating System Division at Microsoft. By the way, get your free copy of Windows 10 now.
Upgrade. This is exciting. I actually love operating system stuff. When I was in school, we had to write our own operating system called Yalnix. Get it? Yalnix. And it was like seriously the most difficult thing I've ever done, so bless you for your work. It's exciting.
Yeah, we try and make sure that learning operating systems is really hard so you guys think we're a lot better than we are.
That's awesome. So let's talk about security. When you're writing an operating system, how do you deal with the kind of issues that come up with security?
Well, security turns out to be exceedingly important because if you don't have it, you're really sorry and you're really mad at somebody. So we do a lot of thinking, particularly within the kernel group, about security and actually throughout Microsoft. But there's a particular problem that our group here worked on within the current release, Windows 10, that has to do with making security a lot better for certain kinds of secrets. So I'd like to tell you about that.
Let's do that. So let's start with the following. When we're talking about security, usually we're trying to protect something. What is it that we're trying to protect in this instance?
Well, that's true. People think about security and they think about things like, well, can I log into the system? Do I have to give a password? Who can access my stuff and things like that? Well, since we're in the kernel team here, we tend to think a lot lower in the system. We try to think of the mechanisms and stuff whereby people can build on top of that and do stuff. So fundamentally, when I think about this kind of security, the stuff we're going to talk about today, it's how do we keep certain kinds of secrets so that people can't steal them? Because it's not so much that your computer thinks that somebody else is you, it's that the internet does, and they're posting on your Facebook account, and they're sending tweets that you never would have sent, and they're visiting websites that you tell your wife, I never would have gone there, honey.
Sure.
And so you don't want people to be able to steal your identity on your computer. And so we'll talk about how we're doing that in Windows 10.
All right, well, let's start. How do we solve this problem?
Okay, well, I'm not going to solve the problem, just to be clear on that, because whenever you say, I have solved the security problem, a whole lot of people very quickly let you know that you haven't. But we think we've made some fundamental progress on how we think about solving certain kinds of security problems. So because I'm a kernel guy, I'd like to start at a low level of the system and draw you a picture of how an operating system is structured and show you where some of the problems are and some of the innovations that we're making in Windows 10.
All right, this is exciting. Let's go to it.
So, now everybody has different ways that they draw these kinds of pictures. Like Logan there has already told me several times today that he would draw all his pictures differently. So forgive me if I don't draw this picture the way that you did it when you were working on Yalnix.
Okay.
But I think of the world largely as broken into two pieces. And one is the kernel, or kernel mode. It's a part of the processor architecture. And the other is user mode. And so these are things that the computer architecture support in the instruction sets. And people often think of this as being the operating system, although actually the operating system has a lot of other things that are not just the kernel. And they think of this as being, well, really two things. You have the libraries that you get from the system, so you have lots of libraries, and you have your executable code or your program. And this is like the code that you write or the code that you click on and something runs. And up here in the kernel, there's like a whole bunch of, we'll just call them data structures. And these describe what this looks like. They let you say, oh, you opened a file, we'll connect you up over here to some other data structure, and eventually you go out to a disk and you actually get access to the file. So these data structures describe all that you're doing. Now, if your program's running, one of the things that operating systems do is they isolate your program from other programs. And this is sometimes so we can make them secure and not be able to interact with each other. And other times it's just to solve certain kinds of bugs that you might have. So if this program screws up, it doesn't cause this program to crash. And so these things, as everybody probably knows, are called processes. A process is a running instance of a program under an operating system. So you get several of these. And you get up to the kernel and actually they're all kind of shared. When I draw these boxes, these are what we call address spaces. It means that if I have an address like a pointer, what can it refer to? If I have a pointer here in this part, in the user space, I can only refer to this container. I can refer to everything in that process. This guy can't refer there in general. There's some special cases, but he can refer to the stuff here. The operating system can kind of refer to all the data structures everywhere because that's how kernels tend to be organized.
So let's pause right here to ask, I'm going to ask some questions. So a kernel is just like a program that's running mm-hmm. all the time.
Yes.
And sometimes, for example, because programmers, for some reason, I always think that the code that I'm writing is the only thing ever running on the machine. That's right. Definitely not the case.
Right.
And so each process has its own space to do work,
yes.
like its own scratch space
yes.
and its libraries that it's loaded up.
Yes.
And sometimes it will switch between user mode into kernel mode when it needs to get, like, for a file.
That's
for
right.
example.
Exactly.
Got it.
That's exactly right. So I guess that operating system course did pay
Thank
off.
Thank goodness.
Because the way that Yolinux works is the way that the operating system, the Windows operating system, works too. Now, the next thing I want to point out about security, since that's really the purpose of today's talk, is to say that the operating system can run some code here, and he can reach down and see stuff in this process, this running program, because he needs to copy some data from the disk, he needs to get some parameters because you want him to do something for you, send a message to somebody, access a web page, has to open some files and some network stuff. And so they communicate back and forth, and the operating system can reach down here. And he can also reach down over here.
And the reason why is because, for example, if a program loads a file,
yeah.
like the memory space of the kernel is different than the memory space of the user, and so
yes.
sometimes it needs to translate and say, here is where the file is
yes.
according to you.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, this is all absolutely great because, as you know from Yolinux, from the way we socialized how hard kernels are and stuff, it has kind of this magical kind of property of all this magic that happens up here, and so people revere what goes on in the kernel.
It is sacrosanct.
It is. And so they think of, well, this is where all the trouble is, and this is the really good stuff. This is the hard stuff. This is, and, you know, there was a point in time where maybe that was sort of true, but it turns out that this is the heart of how things happen in the operating system, and everybody wants to play up here. We're extremely democratic about it. If you want to develop some new device that hangs off of the system, by and large, you may want to write a device driver which actually lives up here with the rest of the kernel stuff that you get from Microsoft, and it's code that you wrote. And one guy told me, this is like 10 years ago, he says, you know, we get about 1 million different drivers a month. And that was back then. And that doesn't mean 1 million distinct drivers in terms of doing different things,
right.
but just drivers are, we give you a lot of help. Drivers are relatively easy to write. There's a ton of code up here. And so the more code you get up here, the more likelihood that you have bugs. And sometimes the drivers themselves aren't all that well written. And in fact, we've actually made some mistakes ourselves. We've taken large pieces of code and moved them into the kernel for performance, and it turns out that there were some problems with that. Well, what do problems translate into? Problems mean
right.
that somebody can figure out how to get the code that's running up here in the kernel to do its bidding. They can take control of it.
Now, I feel like I'm having a losing my religion moment here because the kernel to me was always sort of the source of the trueness of the actual machine.
Yeah.
What you're saying is that someone can, even without any malice, write something that works in kernel space that can inject stuff into user mode to do stuff on your behalf.
Right. So, at one point in time, I remember somebody came from another team and they said, we'd like you to protect two user mode processes from each other because we have certain content, movies or something. I used to call this Make the World Safe for Disney Movies, but I don't know who the company was that
right.
we were doing this for. And they said, well, we like to protect this. And I said, well, what about the kernel? He says, well, kernel's hard. And I said, well, we give you all this help so you can write a device driver, we give you these things called toaster drivers, and they already work, and you just modify them and you load them. It's not hard to get a device driver. So if I was going to steal content from one of these and I could load a device driver, that's pretty straightforward. And he says, but kernel's hard. And I said, no, here's what's hard about kernel. Writing a driver that doesn't have any bugs and never crashes, that can be hard. Writing one that just runs and most of the time does what you want, that's pretty easy. So that's the thing that you were saying too, that it is so easy with no malice to put code up in kernel mode, which has bugs in it. And if you have bugs in code, we've all learned this lesson now.
Oh my goodness.
I can take over control of that code, whether it's driving your Jeep Cherokee or...
And it's, the sad thing is, like, if you're not, for example, if you're not checking the bounds of your buffer, you could somehow put something into the instruction pointer to push some kind of code to the user mode. And that's kind of scary. And the reason why I said it's kind of like losing my religion is because now instead of protecting the computer from the user code, we have to protect the user code from the kernel. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. That's the innovation that has gone into Windows 10 called isolated user mode. So I draw you some more of this picture here, and I'm going to do it, start off by drawing another line here, and we will call this section here, I guess I'll write it up here, we'll call this normal. This is normal mode. And this we'll call secure mode. Now, in operating system parlance and the way that Intel chips work, this is actually known as ring 3, and this is known as ring 0, okay? But really it's just the kernel mode where the kernel code and the drivers and things like that run, and user mode where that runs. And there is a ring 1 and 2, we just don't really use them very much. But orthogonal to that, in the opposite direction, opposite axis, we're seeing we're going to have a normal mode and a secure mode, okay? And then what I really want to do is simply this. I want to take one of these processes and secure it.
Okay.
Now, remember when the guy came to me and he said, gee, we'd like to keep these two processes from talking to each other? Well, about 10 years ago, we did some work called protected processes. Because in the Windows operating system, things are very powerful, and I won't go through all the history of why we made them so powerful, but it let us build lots of compatibility into the system. So we had all these processes that could actually talk to other processes if they were owned by the same user.
I see.
Okay. So protected processes says, well, I want this to be my process, I launched it, but whoever wrote the code doesn't want me to be able to reach in and take data out of it, like just using an example of stealing a movie or something, although that's not the most important example,
right. But
that would be an example. But what we want to do in Windows 10 is get rid of the user mode part of the process. The data structures are all still here, but I'm going to take that and I'm going to stick it over here, complete with the libs and the program. And what's the difference between normal and secure? The difference is this, that this ring zero, this kernel mode code here, doesn't have any access to this. It cannot see the data, unlike here where we showed how you could reach all the data.
So how is that possible? Because my understanding is the kernel is doing some admin level stuff, and sometimes in user mode, you have to ask for a file, or ask for the next packet, or ask for whatever the driver it is. How does it give you that in a secure way?
That's right. And so we do have something called a secure kernel, which if I could draw better, you would see that said secure kernel. Unlike the regular kernel over here, this is actually really not a full kernel. In fact, people shouldn't be misled by the name. It's what I used to call a proxy kernel, because it does exactly what you said. If I want to access the network or a file, or I want to signal a synchronization object or something, the program calls into this kernel, not into the normal kernel. But this guy doesn't implement those functions. He passes them over here. Well, why did he have to do that? He had to do that because the memory here isn't accessible, and some of the arguments to the system calls are in memory. So he does have a shared buffer.
On the kernel side.
On the kernel side, which is shared by both normal and secure mode. And he copies stuff into the shared buffer. This is a process that's known as marshalling, where you take stuff from one address space and you make it available in a different set of addresses. And you do things like pack it together neatly, and there are other things you do. Remote procedure calls use that kind of technique a lot. So essentially, the secure kernel implements a kind of remote procedure call so that a system call, and I should say more about what a syscall is in a minute, actually is implemented over here like always, just like the system calls from this process are implemented over here. But the secure kernel or the proxy kernel marshals the request and marshals the results back.
It's so almost like a officer in between, making sure that everything's happening on the up and up.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, it's a little bit, sometimes I think of it like you can still, well, I don't know who does this anymore, but if you drive up to a bank and not to the drive-up ATM and you talk to the teller, you know, or gas stations have this too, that drawer that kind of comes out.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that, right? That you're, this guy is saying, oh, well, I don't have access to everything in the booth, but I can put something in here and pass it out to you so you have access to it. So it's
I see. And so how does the kernel not know about the address space in the secure mode?
Ah, that's the magic question. So I'm going to erase this. I'm going to tell you that story if that's okay.
Let's do that. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
So in our team, in the kernel team, we had this idea that we might want to get separation between what was accessible from the kernel and what was in user mode. And it turned out that the virtualization guys had already been at work building a feature to support this very thing into Windows 10. And that feature is called Virtual Secure Mode. Okay. And what virtual secure mode does has to do with how address translation takes place. Now, address translation is what people think of, that's what's underneath, that's the implementation of what people think of as virtual memory. Mm-hmm. And a virtual memory, you have an address, but it gets mapped into the actual physical address. Well, why is that? That's so that I can have two processes, and they can both say, well, here's address 1600. And this guy has address 1600 because that's how I wrote my program. Mm-hmm. But they don't refer to the same actual memory. They refer to a virtual address of 1600. And it's different in the different processes.
Not only that, but when your page faulting and you're going to disk.
That's right.
And you
have all that to do too. But this is the key about address translation. And I'll go ahead and describe, since you asked about that, about how the page fault stuff work. But basically what happens is each of these process has a different page table. Mm-hmm. And this page table, there's some interesting complexity about how you actually represent this, because these address spaces with 64 bits are very large now. But basically think of it as just a table. And you stick in 1600, and it's a table, and you go down and find an entry for 1600. And out comes
OXABC.
Yeah, some other address, like, you know, 9900. And for this one, 1600 might bring out, 13,000. It'd be a different address. And this is the actual memory location that you're using. And this is called a page table, and this is how we implement virtual memory. To add a couple more details, just because you asked about this, in addition to getting this out, I also get out access information. Access information does things like say, oh, are you allowed to execute what's on that page or not? Actually run it as instructions? It also says that you can't write it, you can't modify it. That's important because I might be sharing it with another program to reduce my memory use. So if it's the same memory, the same contents, why don't I just share the page?
We
do that for code and libraries, for example. We do that a lot. And suppose I don't have any access and it says this is invalid. Then the operating system kicks in, and the operating system, the kernel runs and the memory manager and says, oh, let me go see if that's true. It is. That's not a valid page. You made a mistake.
Yeah.
Oh, we give you an exception. We give you a chance to fix yourself, but we know something's wrong. But very often, this is what paging is, as you were mentioning paging. We say, oh, that's right. We didn't have a physical page to give you, so we took away your access, but we'll go get you one, we'll go out to the disk, say, and we'll copy in that page from disk into the physical memory, and then you have access. So this is paging. It gives you different address spaces for each of these processes. The kernel also has part of the same address space. It has a different set of addresses that it uses. And this is all under the control of the operating system kernel.
So how do we get to secure? Well, because obviously you're looking at the kernel, and the kernel has access to the page table, and so it knows where all the memory is. How do we prevent the kernel from accessing that memory?
See, you keep asking the same question. It's a good question, and it's taking a little bit of time because there's a lot of complexity behind how this works. But this part, I think you understand, because it's probably, if you did virtual memory in Yalnix, you had something like this. Now, in the world we're in now, so I'm going to erase this part, and I'm going to talk about virtual machines for a minute. So we have this hypervisor as part of Hyper-V, but this part of Hyper-V is actually called the hypervisor. It's a layer of code that actually runs underneath the operating system kernel. So now I'm going to draw the kernel on top of this. This is sometimes called ring minus one, which means that when we were numbering rings, they didn't realize they were going to need another one below zero.
To load multiple operating systems on the same machine, the hypervisor takes care of that.
That's right. And so if I have these different, we'll call these virtual machines, each of them has an operating system kernel. Each of it thinks it's manipulating page tables. And each of them coughs out something like, what did we say? I forget what the addresses were, but we coughed out, say, 13,000, I think, was one of them. That's the actual physical address. And without the hypervisor and this kind of thing, that would just be the address of an actual physical page. But now I have the same problem I have with processes. This guy is also spitting out 13,000.
And so now the hypervisor becomes a pseudo OS for OSs.
Yes, exactly. And we use a similar mechanism to what we described about the page table. We have something here which you put in 13,000, and you get out some other address, which is like, you know, maybe 99,000. And you have a different table for this VM than you have for this VM, so the answer for this VM might be 109,000. And so what we call these is the original address with the page table is a virtual address, or VA. This is called a guest physical address because these are guest operating systems. Mm-hmm. And this is called a system physical address because it's, for all intents and purposes, as far as the software is concerned, the real address in memory. And so we have the same thing we had before, which is we also have some access. So far what I've shown you is that using the same kind of mechanism that we used in the regular page tables, we can make these, kind of like they were processes, have a different set of mappings. Now, because we already had the virtual address translation, the primary mapping, this is called SLAT, second level address translation.
And this is interesting because every time I'm going to install like Hyper-V, it says you need SLAT,
yes,
or SLAT, and this is what this is. It's
yes,
a
it
hardware
is.
Thing.
That's right, and we used to sort of try and run on machines that did not have it, and it was a lot slower. And more recent releases of Windows require that you have hardware that's SLAT capable to run the hypervisor.
Got it.
Now, this is all existing kind of basic stuff. And now I'm going to answer your question finally. And the answer to the question is really pretty simple, which is without having multiple virtual machines, and I just have normal mode, and I have secure mode,
which is a diagram we had before.
Diagram we had before. And I have a page table here. And this is the we'll call the NT operating system kernel. And over here is the secure kernel. It also has page tables for each of the processes. They're different page tables. They're managed differently on the different sides. Okay, but the thing we do is we give them a different second level translation. So there's a different SLAT here than there is here. This is all controlled by the hypervisor.
Interesting.
Now, here's what they did, is they said, look, if I have address 13,000 over here, well, I'm going to map that to 99,000, say. And then over here, if I have 13,000, I'm going to map that to 99,000. Now, wait a minute. Why do I have two different slats, two different address translation tables, if I'm just going to map them to the same, and remember this was the system physical address and this was the guest physical address. If I'm going to map it to the same system physical address, why?
It feels like the SLAT will be able to tell you different protection modes.
Exactly.
So when they're communicating, the SLAT will say, yeah, you have access, but you can't write to it, or you can't read from it.
Or you can't execute it.
Like got
that.
It.
That's exactly correct. And
I
so
see.
That, you, after all that, you answered your own question.
There
questions,
you go. Jeff. See that?
That is how it works. And I'm really impressed with the University of Utah's operating system class now because you got it exactly right.
And it feels like secure kernel mode is almost lifting it to the status of almost a VM, but not with all
yes.
this. It's like a mini tiny VM for that process.
Exactly.
Got it.
And they use it to construct these different modes. And really, this whole thing replicates because this could be in like a VM3, And there could be another one, which was VM4, say, which would also have normal and secure mode as part of the same virtual machine.
So now we're getting like Inception, right? Like a mini VM inside a big VM with a hypervisor. This is craziness.
It's absolute insanity, actually.
Nice.
So that's how we get the mechanism. We're using this virtual secure mode feature that's in the hypervisor. And we've already showed you how we get IUM, which is isolated user mode. And the reason it was called isolated user mode is because we took the user mode that was normal mode, the normal security mode, and we put it over here so it's protected by the SLAT. Exactly like you said, the difference is this one might be no access, and this one might be read and execute access.
That's interesting. So isolated user mode now is default in Windows 10. As a developer, how do you say, I want my process to be in isolated user mode?
That is a really great question. And we don't know the answer to that. So I'd like to introduce my colleague here, because now we're getting to the tough questions.
Okay.
And so Logan will actually tell you what we actually use this for, because this isn't a facility that we put in for, in this release at least, and we're not sure what we'll do in future releases. We'll talk about that.
Cool.
In the next release. It's a feature that we're using internally to solve a couple of important problems, and so Logan will talk about that.
All right, let's pause for a second and get him up.